sliding under the great chassis of Medicare to see what's going on.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California and is supported by Join Me, an instant online meeting app used by millions of people to collaborate and get work done anywhere. More at join.me.
From APM in New York, I'm David Brancaccio. We'll have the global perspective on business and economics in just a moment. But first, some newspapers this morning have an early look at a treasure trove of new data about where the money flows in the system to get health care to older and disabled Americans, Medicare. One headline, a tiny portion of doctors accounts for a large portion of Medicare spending. 1% of the providers generate 14% of the Medicare bills. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more on this new data resource.
Imagine you had access to your doctor's vital statistics, how much they charge Medicare for a certain procedure, kind of like statistics on baseball players. Jean Mitchell teaches public policy at Georgetown. She says for many doctors,
their patients will be quite surprised to see how much money they're making and the volume of procedures that they perform.
Mitchell also says the new data could spotlight conflicts of interest, like when a doctor who owns an MRI machine orders lots of MRIs. But doctors worry the new information will be taken out of context. Reed Blackwelder is president of the American Academy of Family Physicians. More than a third of his patients are covered by Medicare, and he says they need a lot of tests.
60% of all Medicare patients actually have three or more medical conditions. Our patients are extremely complex.
In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Amid renewed tension between Moscow and Kiev, Russia controls a lifeline for Ukraine, which buys its natural gas from Gazprom, a company owned by the Russian government. Ukraine hasn't been paying its gas bills, and on top of that, Gazprom has jacked up the price, ending the discounts, is how Gazprom views it. Reporter David Stern is covering Ukraine for the BBC, and he joins us now from Kiev. David, good morning.
Good morning.
So the natural gas is still flowing in from Russia to Ukraine despite the unpaid bills?
Yes, as far as we can tell, it's still flowing. That would be a very big escalation, obviously. If that were to happen, that would send alarm bells off not just in Ukraine but in Europe, because the Russians also send a large amount of the gas that Europe buys through the Ukrainian pipeline.
I see on the wires that Russian President Putin is set to meet with some of his advisors. Any announcements presumably will be closely watched in Kiev.
Indeed, yes. They'll be watching very closely. So we've already heard a number of announcements, obviously, up until now. The Russians have increased the price twice for a sum total of about an 80% increase. And then the Russians have also said the Ukrainians haven't paid their gas bills this month or for last month. The Ukrainians, for that matter, have said they're not going to pay the gas bills until some agreement is reached on the price. They say the previous price was perfectly fine. So obviously some negotiating has to go on here because the two sides don't seem very close together.
David Stern files for the BBC from the Ukrainian capital, Kiev. David, thank you.
Thank you.
Over time, not tomorrow, not next week, but longer run, Ukraine and Western Europe are looking for ways to taper away from Russian energy. That means Gazprom may need new customers, and there's news that the Russian state-owned gas company is nearing a new deal to sell gas to China, a relationship that could be finalized next month. Now let's check the numbers. The FT 100 in London is up 0.7% right now. The key index in Hong Kong rose 1.1%. Dow, S&P, and NASDAQ futures are up.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Allianz, managing more than $2 trillion in assets and providing investment solutions through its affiliated companies in the U.S. AllianzUSA.com. By Reputation.com, offering tools to manage online reviews and search results for professionals and small businesses. Learn more at Reputation.com. And by Burst, cloud business analytics engineered to turn data into knowledge. Burst lets companies think fast. Learn more at BIRST.com. Burst, think fast.
It's 30 years since the start of a crippling strike by coal miners in Britain over mine closures. The strike turned out to be a turning point for the UK's coal industry and for Britain's labor movement. The miners lost that battle, and hundreds of mines were mothballed. Two of the last three now face closure. But why did Britain decide to stop digging? Was it about coal or was it political? As part of our series Coal Play, our veteran correspondent Stephen Beard reports from the former coal fields of South Yorkshire.
A brass band leads a small procession marking the 30th anniversary of the miners' strike and mourning what has been called the political assassination of a great industry. Ex-miner Mike Clark says coal mining was murdered by the Prime Minister of the day, Margaret Thatcher.
She will do everything she can to break the working class of Great Britain.
And you think that's what the pit closures were about?
Yes, I do.
The miners believe that Thatcher was out to crush their union, the country's most powerful and militant. Christine Rawson, who was brought up in a mining village.
It was an identified agenda set out by the Thatcher government that she would redress the balance back in favour of capitalism, that unions would not gain strength and would lose strength.
We have to bring about a fair and just balance between a man's right to withhold his labour.
The late Thatcher's plan to curb union power was right, claims Oxford professor Dieter Helm. Before she came to office, Britain was crippled by more than 2,000 strikes a year.
There was a general consensus that trade union power had basically reached a level that the British economy could no longer really function.
And he says the pit closures were also driven by the high cost of deep pit mining.
That contraction of the coal industry was economically correct. It had to happen. It was going to happen. It would have happened anyway.
The international trade in coal grew fast in the 1980s. Andrew Angus of the Cranfield School of Management says Britain's deep mines couldn't compete with cheap imports.
Inexpensive supplies of high-quality coal from open-cast mining in South Africa, Australia, at the US began to compete away the UK's coal's market.
And then he says there was the issue of energy security. Thatcher claimed it was safer to rely on foreign coal than on the output of British miners. She once called them the enemy within. In South Yorkshire, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Our Marketplace's PM show later today. Stephen goes to a village next to one of the old pits to check in 30 years later. And tomorrow morning, he'll examine pressure for the UK to reopen some of its deepest coal mines. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
The way people say hello can tell you a lot more than you think.
When you meet somebody in New Orleans for the first time, you might say, "Hey, how's your mama in there?"
I'm sorry, how's your mama? I'm Kai Rizdahl. That story and the rest of the day's business news next time on Marketplace. It's from APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.